Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. Welcome to my program, aptly enough named the Michael Cutler Hour. Wonder how we got that catchy name. Hope you all had a great week. Hope you're looking forward to an exciting weekend. Spring is upon us. The weather in New York is warm. We've had some thunderstorms, but they say the weather should be good. I hope it's good wherever it is that you're listening to my program. Those of you who are familiar with me know that I am a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Then ever since the attacks of 9/11, I decided to take my show on the road, so to speak, and try to get our fellow Americans and get our elected representatives, supposed leaders, and I use that term advisedly, leaders, to understand just how significant our immigration laws are, not just in terms of national security. Certainly that is a major factor. I mean, gosh, how can you possibly seriously talk about protecting our country from those folks who would come here and kill us or do harm to us without securing our borders, without creating an immigration system that has real integrity, that not only protects us, but honors the so many millions of lawful immigrants who over the past couple of centuries came to America and built this country, people from the four corners of the planet. You know, the immigration laws aren't just about keeping people out, it's about letting people in, people who can truly help to build the American dream, a dream that most of our politicians today can't seem to disband quickly enough, can't seem to want to disassemble quickly enough, because it wasn't just having lots of people come to America that made America America and provided us with what came to be known around the world as the American dream, made this country the envy of the world. It was the fact that in the United States, anybody who was willing to work hard, acquire a skill, an education, a trade, could aspire to make more money and bootstrap himself or herself up the economic ladder. That was the American dream. Still is, but it's becoming more and more difficult to attain it because now we have American workers competing with foreign workers. We're told we have a war on drugs, yet the food police is out more concerned about sugar and salt and cocaine and heroin. So all that's going on today defies rational thought, defies understanding. And this is the message that I bring with me wherever I go, whether it's this program or over at AND Magazine, A-N-D, AND Magazine, where I have my own website, talkborder.com. One word, TALKBORDER, talkborder.com. Well, when I write occasionally for California's Population Stabilization website, where I am a senior fellow, my message is constant. It's clear. We can't protect our country and our citizens without securing our borders and enforcing our immigration laws. For those of you who want to read more about me, if you're not that familiar with me, please go to my website, michaelcutler.net. You can read about my bio, where I've been, how I got here, because what I want you to understand first and foremost is that the stuff that I talk about isn't something that I dreamt up last week and so now I'm out here spewing. I started working for what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service a very long time ago, longer ago than I care to remember. I started working for the INS back in October 1971. My career spanned some 30 years. I've testified before some 15 congressional hearings. I gave testimony to the 9/11 Commission, and I've provided expert witness testimony at legislative hearings around the country, as well as at federal trials where immigration was at issue. So here we are. It's Friday. And today, in a couple of minutes, I'll be joined by an old friend and colleague, Mark Hager. And when I say colleague, we're looking at the broadcast side. Mark is a co-host of a radio program in North Carolina, Statesville, North Carolina, called Your Mark on History. And in fact, last week, I was Mark's guest on his program because he arranged for me to go to North Carolina to speak at an event where we talked about immigration. The event was called the Forum on Illegal Immigration, We were supposed to have Cochise County, Arizona Sheriff Larry Deaver join us. Unfortunately, he couldn't. He had a family emergency. But Mark, in fact, filled in for him, did a terrific job. We had the Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page also address the audience. So understand that this immigration issue isn't just about the so-called four border states. In very real terms, the immigration crisis impacts every single one of our states. And in fact, I always like to point out that any state that has a seaport or an international airport has to be considered a border state. And when aliens run our borders, they don't simply do what Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin did. They don't set foot on the American side of the border, plant the flag, grab some rocks, and go home. If they should do that, that would be a big favor. And then we could collect the flags, I guess. What they do is they come across that border and they're headed for the rest of the country. And our politicians, many of them from both sides of the aisle, have created a very clear message for these folks that if you come to America, if you violate the laws that are designed to protect American lives and protect American jobs, not only will we tolerate it, we will reward you. We will, in fact, reward you with a pathway to citizenship, because that is what the Obama administration has made clear it would love to do for God knows how many illegal aliens. Of course, the estimates have hovered around the 11 million mark for many years. We're now being told the numbers are down. I guess the problem has been solved all by itself. And if you believe that story, I have a fence to sell you. But it's, you know, this immigration issue is so huge and so daunting, and I can't imagine any other problem being ignored for so long with so many people looking to reward illegal conduct. And it extends to what we've seen in California, where the state law says that if a person drives a car without a license, the vehicle is subject to impoundment for 30 days. Los Angeles now says, nope, we won't do that. We don't want to inconvenience illegal immigrants, illegal aliens, whatever they want to call them, undocumented workers. In point of fact, illegal alien is not a pejorative. The term alien simply means any person who's not a citizen or national. But rather than inconvenience these folks who should not be here, should not be working, they will immediately return the car to them as long as somebody shows up with some kind of ID. God only knows. And so we wind up with tragedies. And a couple of weeks ago, I had a gentleman by the name of Don Rosenberg on the program. His 25-year-old son, second-year law student, was killed by an alien from El Salvador whose car was taken from him because he drove without a license, drove the wrong way on a one-way street, I might add, and they simply gave him back the car, and shortly thereafter, he ran over Don's son, not once, but three times, and killed him. This is the lunacy. And today, I can't tell you how many people sent me an email about a loophole in the IRS laws. And it was featured on a television news broadcast in Indiana, of all places. And in fact, I was thrilled to go to Indiana last year, where I worked with Senator Mike Delft and a bunch of folks from an organization called iFire. These are Indianans who are all about enforcing the immigration laws. They asked me to come out and speak at the hearing, which I did. We got SB 590 passed, which is a law similar to the Arizona law that would empower the state to enforce a number of statutes that largely parallel the federal immigration statutes. Well, the story that was being broadcast was a mind-boggler. According to the Inspector General for the Treasury Department, I believe, 4.2 billion dollars is being returned to illegal aliens who claim to have children, but these are kids that don't even live with them, kids living back in their home country, predominantly Mexico, according to the story. And what was so remarkable was you saw the way that the paperwork was done, where they were listing nieces and nephews, not only their immediate children. Imagine if you or I did that on your tax return. Imagine if you started taking credit for all kinds of kids so you could get that kid's tax credit to help you take care of your children. I guarantee you, you would come under the magnifying glass, and if they found that you were lying, I'm sure you would wind up in jail. You would be prosecuted. Here, you have families claiming that there were 10 or 15 children that they are taking care of, And in fact, in case in point in the story, they went to a little house. The only young person they found was one young girl who was kicking a soccer ball around. And when they asked the guy who lived there, are there any other kids here? He said, no, they're all back in Mexico. But that's okay. The IRS just sent those checks south of the border to Mexico, over $4 billion. You add to that the more than $20 billion in remittances that get sent back to Mexico every year by illegal aliens from Mexico working in our country. Now, when these folks work here, understand what it means. They're displacing American workers. This fantasy that illegal aliens do the work Americans won't do is just that. It's a fantasy, but it's worse than that. It's an insult. Think of how many hardworking American men and women or lawful immigrants who are here with green cards entitled to work who can't find work because they are being undercut by illegal aliens. Think about workers in the high-tech industries, the computer programmers and so forth, who are being undercut by H-1B visas and L-1 visas when we're bringing in the high-tech workers purportedly because Americans are too stupid to do those jobs. Absolutely outrageous. I see Mark is on the line, so let me bring him on board with us. Mark Hager, happy Friday.
Hey, how are y'all doing?
Well, I'm all doing fine. How are you all doing?
Oh, we're doing pretty good here in North Carolina.
Well, you know, we can always tell that when we have somebody from south of the line that we become all. So we
That's
are
right.
all fine here in New York. Mark played host for a number of days. You know, I keep thinking you should turn your house into a Red Roof Inn.
Well, we've had so many people here. Maybe not as many dignitaries such as yourself.
Oh my gosh!
But we've had a number, and of course, Marizona, you know, Sheriff Devers is. All of them are welcome to be here. Anybody trying to work to save this nation, like you all have, and it's an honor to have you all stay here and try to show you a little bit of Carolina hospitality.
Well, I have to tell you, you and your neighbors demonstrated what we all know is known as Southern hospitality. You guys really made me feel so much at home. I almost felt as though I was visiting with family. And I will never forget it. I certainly appreciate it. And I hope to get back to your neck of the woods. The scenery there, folks, is unbelievable. You know, you're driving down these highways, you know, gently rolling through the hills and all the foliage and the trees and the grass and the grazing cows and the horses, and my gosh, it's an amazing place to be, I have to tell you. And I'm a city boy, you know.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that. I just don't think that I could handle living right inside New York City. I think it would look strange at night looking up at the sky.
When you could see it. But there's a good thing about New York air. You get to see what you're breathing.
Yeah.
You know, you put together an amazing event last week, the Forum on Illegal Immigration. Why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about the forum and what provided you with the incentive to do that?
Well, that forum actually started some time ago. You could look back and say that forum was beginning to be put together last year. I had the honor of going down, and, well, Sheriff Devers sent out an invitation to go down to just see what is happening on the border. And while we went down to Cochise County, Arizona, which instrumentally I forgot that Tombstone, Arizona is in Cochise, and we have been so busy working with the sheriff's office and operations along the border that we were kind of tired. And he said, would you like to see Tombstone? And I said, like, the Tombstone? And he said, yes, it's in my county. And so that was kind of neat. But I learned so much, and the respect that I had towards the sheriff's office and realizing the real threat we have across the nation, that it challenges against their authority. And so when I came back to North Carolina, I was wanting to talk with our different sheriffs and see just how much illegal aliens and crimes driven from illegal immigration and human smuggling, you name it, how much is it already impacting. And sure enough, as soon as you talk to some of these sheriffs here, I mean, its alarms went off everywhere. And, you know, they have been trying to get the word out. And, of course, that many times if you start going after illegal aliens and looking at the crimes that are there that are deriving from this here, sometimes you can get labeled a racist and all that kind of good stuff, which you already know. But
well, yeah, I've had all kinds of barbs thrown at me because of this. But, you know, it's remarkable. I've debated the ACLU and La Raza and all those other fun groups.
Mm-hmm.
And initially they used to say that aliens don't commit crime when they get here because they just want to work hard.
Right.
I mean, it's just astonishing. The Ministry of Truth is alive and well. George Orwell would be astonished. But, you know, what's remarkable, I think we talked about this when I was visiting with you. Back in the late 80s, 1988, I was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration in New York. In fact, I was the first INS agent assigned there. It was an interesting assignment because sitting right across from me were two FBI agents, a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, some folks from Customs, the Marshal Service, the IRS, City and State Police. We even had a guy from British Customs sitting there with us. So whoever we needed, whatever we needed, if I just got up and walked 15 feet, I could meet with the person from that agency most likely, and we could work cooperatively. And I woke up one day and thought, you know, I'm here helping DEA with its mission. Maybe we can get DEA to help INS. So I asked them to provide me with arrest statistics so I could figure out who's getting arrested. Well, it was kind of one of those deals where they say, be careful what you wish for, you might get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I waited about 2 weeks, nothing happened. I didn't want to bother anybody. You know, you're a guest. It's not your place. It's their place. And I came to work one day, walked through the door half asleep with a cup of coffee in my hand, and I couldn't see my desk because there were boxes all the way up to the ceiling surrounding my desk. They were on my desk, around my desk, under my desk, on my chair. And as I started moving stuff around, more boxes were coming in hand trucks. These were the arrest statistics, believe it or not.
Yeah, I heard
and
you mention that.
I'm sorry?
I heard you mention that, and they were piled up around you.
It was unbelievable. It was amazing. It looked like moving day, you know, and these forms were moving. And this wasn't on a computer database the way we would have it today where you can crunch the nut. I was sitting there literally with a calculator, a pencil, and a pad. And when I got done figuring, and when I thought I had finally found the light at the end of the tunnel, it was another train because they brought me some more boxes, of course. Well, finally, this took about 2 weeks to tabulate. I found out that in New York, 60% of the people that we were arresting for drug-related crimes were identified as being foreign-born. Now, I don't know if they became naturalized citizens or not, because with all the information that we put on arrest records, the one question we don't ask, and Congressman Steve King and a couple of others are trying to get this to be done now, is the immigration status of people being arrested. But think about this. In New York City, how far are we from that Mexican border that we're told is the border? 60% of the people arrested for drug trafficking and related crimes, money laundering, extortion, murder involving drugs and so forth, committed by foreign-born. Nationally, 30%.
Well,
so, you know, when you hear this mythology, well, we have to deal with the four border states, you know, President George W. Bush said I was the governor of a border state. Well, let me tell you, Governor Cuomo here in New York is the governor of a border state. Any state that shares its land border with either Mexico or Canada, any state that has coastline or a seaport, and any state that has an international airport, all are to be considered border states.
Well, I agree with you totally on that, and I was stunned at the amount of crimes being committed in virtually all of our counties, and we've got 100 counties here in North Carolina, and, it, you know, some of these sheriffs were just glad that someone is willing to discuss this because sometimes they're at wit's end, and the seizures of drugs all across. I mean, in places that you would never even and think of in terms of seizures, such in Rockingham County here, in terms of, you know, you're looking at, thousands of kilos that have over time that has been recovered in places where there is not much places. And from the mountains all the way down to the coast of North Carolina, and then certainly as you get in closer to our urban areas to where there is a constant impact that has really risen, and I've calculated since about 2002, 2003, in that time frame, you can really see the mushrooming. And so what I'd like to say is that, like you would say, you know, you focus upon the Mexican border and you think of the coyotes that you hear so much about that are spotting and moving drugs back and forth. And, you know, they've got encrypted messaging. They've got night vision. They've got everything, and even better than some of our own law enforcement. But what I try to stress to the public is that, you know, you can look at those coyotes down there on the border, but they're no longer there anymore. I use the term coyote all across the United States. They are now setting up in any neighborhood that you can think of. If they can sell drugs, then they're already there setting up, and they're moving drugs, human smuggling.
Here's the deal that we saw, Mark. You know, the drug trade involves lots of money,
mm-hmm.
and really, really incredible sums. And there's a lot of jealousy and envy as far as the cartel leaders are concerned. So what they want to do is make certain that they can rule with an iron fist, to make certain that they won't tolerate corruption within their ranks.
That's right.
They will purchase corruption within law enforcement. They will purchase corruption within the judiciary of Mexico. They will purchase corruption within the Mexican military.
Mm-hmm.
They'll buy corruption, but they won't tolerate corruption. So they send their folks wherever they set up shop. You know, when Janet Napolitano, the head of what I've come to call the Department of Homeland Surrender, says, oh, there's no spillover violence, I want to stand on my chair and yodel. I mean, gosh, understand what they do. There are hundreds of American cities that are now infested by the Mexican cartels. And the way they operate, and this isn't conjecture, folks. I was out there on the street. I was a senior agent with the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force for 10 years, and 4 years prior to that, I was up at DEA Intelligence. Roughly half my career, I was chasing drug dealers and, in some cases, terrorists around. Each one of those operations are run by people generally from their home country. Number one, they tend to trust these people more because they've known them for years, but there's an evil side also. Because when they send people here to shepherd the drugs, to enforce their rule of law, not our rule of law, but certainly they enforce their rule of law, the people who come here know darn well that if they fudge on the numbers, if they skim some money off the top, if a kilo goes missing, or a lot less than a kilo, a family member back home is either going to get raped, killed, tortured. Things will happen to people that are important to the folks running the drug operations here inside the United States. They know there is a good pressure point, and it's easy to apply that pressure to make darn sure that they get 100% compliance. So when you look at the level of violence that plays out on our streets, and it's estimated that perhaps 70% of crime in the United States, directly or indirectly, is drug-related, think of the violence in Mexico. They're rapidly approaching 50,000 Mexicans dead since Felipe Calderon took office. 50,000 dead. So when we hear this nonsense that there's no spillover violence and the borders are secure and we got to stop putting too much sugar in our coffee, but not a word about cocaine, not a word about meth, not a word about marijuana, not a word about heroin or crack. You know, you really have to ask yourself, whose side is the government on? And I don't know if you remember this, Mark. I think the sheriff, unless you made the point, about, was it Wachovia that had laundered over $300
billion? $374.4 billion. And that's, you can go online and Google Wachovia and the UK Guardian. It was their reporter that uncovered that amount. And so,
now, I want you folks out there to understand what we're talking about. When you talk about the resources that are available to the cartels, what can't you buy for nearly $400 billion, whether it's corruption, whether it's the best weaponry? And understand, they don't have a chain of command like we do in the government, where you send memos up and down the chain of command and they study it and they sit there and they cogitate. The guy picks up the phone and says, this is what you're going to do, and an hour later, they're doing it. We sit around. I mean, we're being told we need 10 more years to build a fence. It took us 9 years to go to the moon. But now think of something else. If you wonder why you don't see the commercials, and I have no evidence of this. I'm just speculating, but look how many people are feeding at the trough. How much money do you think Wachovia or other banks that move drug money are getting, whether it's the interest on the money that they hold on to, even if it's just for a matter of days or weeks? Think of the banking fees that they charge for wiring the remittances, for opening the bank accounts, for checking the balance in the account. Think of all those wacky charges you now get. It used to be you went to the bank and they gave you a toaster oven if you opened an account. Now you go to the bank and they grab you by your ankles and shake you until your pockets are empty. They're shameless about it. They get away with it, of course, because the politicians are taking campaign contributions from the banks. So the bankers are literally making out like bandits. The drugs flow freely into our country, screw up how many lives, how many people have been damaged because they had an addiction to cocaine or heroin or crack or meth. Think of what it costs in health care for people whose health suffers the adverse implications of this. Think how many kids that should be in school are out on the street, whether it's girls becoming prostitutes to feed the habit, kids pulling armed robberies and so forth, or they're just so distracted from the use of drugs. But what do we hear about on a daily basis? Be careful that you're sprinkling too much salt on your French fries. Am I missing something here, Mark? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, no, so you can also go and get now apples instead of French fries now.
Oh, okay. Well, then that problem is now solved, so I will sleep tonight. I will sleep the sleep of angels. How crazy is this, Mark? Does this anger you as much as it angers me, or have I just gone off the deep end?
Well, that's one bank, and of course, Wachovia wasn't a giant among banks, and they were bought out. Just as the as this broke out in the UK Guardian, Wachovia was bought out by Wells Fargo. So, you know, there hasn't been, you know, any more news coming out to see, well, what happened with it after the UK Guardian found out with Wachovia, and so how much more is with other banks. But then when you look into that, they're not coming around here with a organization that doesn't know what it's doing. And they learn quickly, or what it appears to me from being down there on the border and then trying to look around here in North Carolina, that they first will try to find all of the systems and institutions that we like and we're accustomed to here and then work and infiltrate those. And, you know, they know here in the Bible Belt, you know, you don't pick on churches. And so we saw on the border where churches are just a front for this organized crime network. And so that's one of the things that kind of made me angry down there, is to realize that, you know, they know us so well and that they continue to bank on us being naive, literally bank on us to be naive to just how strong they have become.
You know, it's just so darn frustrating. And then if you look at where the money is going, see, look, folks, let me tell you something. There's a gal by the name of Rachel Ehrenfeld, Professor Ehrenfeld. She has a PhD in economics. She goes around the world testifying at various government hearings about the link, the nexus between crime and terrorism. She wrote a wonderful book, tough subject, called Funding Evil. I hope to get Rachel on my program within the next couple of weeks, either this radio show or my television that I do at AND Magazine at talkborder.com. Please write those email addresses down, though, folks, if you have a moment. Mm-hmm. Talkborder, one word, .com at AND Magazine. If you just go www.talkborder.com, we're posting videos as well as articles, certainly the radio program here, and I write for CAPS. You know, capsweb.org. But hopefully Rachel will be on with us one way or the other. And she has written extensively about how narcotics and other crimes fund terrorism. So
right.
People are out there getting high, damaging their health, committing crime, and the money is flowing into the coffers of people that are destroying the Mexican government, killing tens of thousands of innocent Mexican victims, coming into our country, killing more people, ruining more lives, and you can't even find a public service announcement issued by the federal government warning people, especially young people, about the perils of drugs. They have great commercials about cigarette smoke. You know, the people with the stoma where they have a voice box because there's a hole in their throat. They show autopsies and diseased lungs. Amazing, graphic. But not a single commercial about cocaine, heroin, meth, none of that stuff.
Well,
and meanwhile, the money is feeding our enemies. And realize that there is a nexus. There was a UN report about it. There is a nexus between the smugglers of narcotics, the smugglers of aliens, and terrorists who want to come into the United States and infiltrate our country.
Well, Mike, if I may add to that.
Sure. Please do. That's why you're here.
We look around, and I think that they honestly feel that as long as they can, we stay happy. You look at TV, and it has all of the same crazy dumb programs on there to entertain you. You can go out and do basically what you need to do, and you can stay entertained, that they can just keep us off just how severe the problem is. It's kind of like I brought up with you, and I think you were saying it was your grandmother or others that were victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah, my grandmother, I was named for her.
But one of the stories that I remember teaching history that I mentioned to you was Jan Karski, who before World War II actually broke out, or at least the War of the United States, had escaped from both Treblinka and Belzec.
Right.
Two massive concentration camps, about as bad as you could be, made it to the United States and was trying to get an audience to hear what was happening, and finally even got to speak to members of Congress. And they looked at him like he was crazy, that Hitler couldn't be that bad. And you think we would learn our lessons from the 1930s. But then you look around now and you're going, you know, we seem to be just as naive then as we are now.
Well, I think it was Einstein who was probably quoting somebody else when he said that insanity was doing the same things the same way and expecting a different outcome.
Right. That is, and so, you know, we know it's here. You can't go outside and drive around and not see that there has been a big change. I don't know about in New York City.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Every city, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, folks, this is not a statement of xenophobia. Please understand this.
Right.
Please understand something.
Mm-hmm.
One of my pet peeves is the issue of language. Do you know in a neighborhood in New York, in a place called Queens, New York, the Korean community is adamant about not putting any English on their store signs any longer? And there was a member of the city council that said, you know, this is really dangerous because someone is sitting in a restaurant and is choking on food or has a heart attack or there's a robbery or a fire. The police, the ambulances, the fire department don't know where to go. They have no idea. And they interviewed one of the local merchants from the organization, the Korean Business Organization, and his response was, well, when you come here, you don't even feel as though you're in America anymore. Isn't that wonderful?
Oh,
and
boy,
I'm thinking, my gosh, people wait a lifetime to come to America so they can live in a community that no longer feels like America. My mother came here as a 14-year-old girl from Poland. She spoke Polish, as you might expect. She spoke Yiddish. We're Jewish. Her first order of business was to learn English. My dad's parents came at the turn of the last century from Russia, Romania. They spoke Russian. They spoke Yiddish. First order of business, learn English. You know, we don't need the same ethnicity, the same religion. In fact, I love diversity. That's why I couldn't imagine living anywhere but New York. But it's language that is the mortar that holds a society together. If you have a bunch of people speaking different languages, you wind up with a Tower of Babel. And, you know, it's remarkable to me, and I'd love to see a study done, but I'm sure you'll never get it done by the state government of New York. In New York, you can get a driver's license or driver's permit for taking the exam in something like, I think it's either 10 or 12 languages. And here's my curiosity, Mark. I'd love to know how many people are involved in accidents who couldn't read the road signs. Think about that. So, you know, I had an antidote for it, but of course they'd never do it. I said that any language that shows up in the material that's given to new drivers, people that want their licenses, whatever language they use, every street sign in the state of New York should have to be posted in every one of those languages.
Oh, my gosh. You'd have to use digital signs, I guess.
Digital signs and enough steel to recreate the World Trade Center, I guess. I mean, how on earth can you be zipping down the Jersey Turnpike and it says in glowing letters, right, slow down, ice ahead? Imagine if you spoke Chinese and no English and you're going 70 miles an hour right into an ice patch because you don't know that that sign is warning you that you're about to hit ice. I mean, lives are on the line, but again, you would think that there'd be real concern. Someone just sent me an article. Here's another good one. You better sit down and put your seatbelt on. Not just you, Mark, but all you folks
yeah.
out there. Put on your seatbelt. Fasten it tightly. TSA is now complaining that it's too arduous. You ready for this one? To do all the background checks on their people. So they're going to let them start working without completing the background checks.
Oh, great. So that's more thousands standing around.
More thousands standing around. And so now who's checking the checkers? Now imagine if you're a bad guy. That means you can allow the drugs to come in, and that just happened at a major international airport. And the way that they found out about it was the guy that had the drugs got confused as to which TSA employee he was supposed to go to, so he went to a legitimate one, not the crooked one. So they found the drugs in the guy's carry-on. I mean, stop and think about what we're talking about. Imagine a terrorist infiltrating the TSA, allowing his buddies to get on board the airplane with weapons, figuring out who the sky marshals are at the same time, by the way, allowing drugs to get on board the airplanes. But meanwhile, we have this theater of national security. We get x-rayed when we go through the airport. I'm convinced I'm going to glow in the dark, and it worries me. You know, I've had prostate cancer. And by the way, for you guys out there, once you hit your 40th birthday, I'm not a doctor, and they don't even play one on TV, but get your PSA checked. That's why I'm still around, which is a good thing because I haven't aggravated my quota yet. But, you know, it's always disconcerting to go to the airport, off come the shoes, into the x-ray machine. I think pretty soon they're going to combine Obamacare with TSA, so you'll go in, you'll get a colonoscopy, a chest x-ray, and God knows what else, maybe mammography, before you can get on an airplane. I mean, how far are we from that now?
Well, I would think that it sounds like the TSA may be our doctors.
Pretty soon.
But even worse than that, when you think about the drug flow that's here, and you look, take my state, North Carolina, is that, every potential drug sale or seizure, it has not just a state effect, it has a world effect.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
The drugs and the people and the apparatus behind it for each person that thinks they're going to have fun and get high one weekend, they don't know the lives that were put in place and from where and what around the world, because we know the cartels are now working in tangent with groups such as Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations, and because there's just so much money in it. So in essence, the United States is funding worldwide terror through these cartels and by just trying to keep up the demand that America seems to have for drugs.
And we're doing nothing, really, to whittle away at that demand. In fact, there was just a study on CBS Radio, the local news station here, talking about how more kids than ever are now smoking marijuana.
I saw that.
So, we know drug use is going up, and I'm going to guess the bankers out there are grinning through their teeth going, yay, more drug money coming in, so that's more money we get our hands on. With the economy the way it is, you really have to wonder what would happen if we could magically suck all the drug money out of the economy. I suspect we wouldn't have an economy.
Well, they don't write checks to each other. So you're looking at cash only. I mean, that is the biggest cash only type business where I would say pretty much around the world. It's in one entity. And so the money that flows is so easy and it's so quick.
It is amazing.
Wired back or laundered back.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it scares you when, somebody like myself, I wasn't in law enforcement like you were for years. I spent some years in the military, but I just wanted to learn what was happening. And of course, I went down, you have to bear in mind, I was only in a very small sector, about an 83-mile sector, the Arizona border with Mexico, that whole border is close to 3,000 miles. And that's just that border. And I was just astounded. I looked at, we had a small team, about four people. That's all the sheriff's department, the sheriff's office said that they could keep with them, you know, for our own safety and the safety of their officers. And I looked around at one point and said that, well, I'm not on drugs, and the other three on this team aren't on drugs. We must be the only four left in the United States. And they just laughed. They said, this is just one small spot. I said, but this is crazy. Where is it all going?
It really is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And then you take into effect what you have told me that you can see out of New York and carry that down to Philadelphia and then out west, Seattle, and other places, other ports of entry across the United States. We're just one great big sponge of drug funds and money that's helping to support terror that many of our troops, I wonder how many of our troops that are fighting overseas in effect have been shot or wounded.
And if you look at Afghanistan, Afghanistan furnishes the bulk of the heroin to England and to the rest of the world, but England, I believe it's their primary source country at this point.
Yeah, didn't we see on some of those maps that were put up that transnational crime coming from Afghanistan, the drugs from it, it's going directly into the Sinaloa cartel or some of the other cartels down in Mexico too, which is coming right back into the United States. So it's, our war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, you just wonder with the money chasing it everywhere. It's kind of like we're fighting in a circle when it all starts with getting a handle of the border and controlling what's coming in and going out of this country.
It is kind of remarkable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. To where it's, Rome, and with my classes, we used to have an argument as to, when did Rome become an entity? When did it become a world power? And it always came down to two dates. And there was, 280 BC and 250 BC.
By the way, I should point out, before you go further, that you're also a history professor.
Right. Well, I used to tell that particular lesson semester after semester. You know how monotonous things get after a while when you get to this point in the notes and you're going, okay, here we go for the upteenth thousand time. And every now and then you get a new spin on it. And we argued, and I said, well, 280 BC, Rome established a rule of law. A rule of law that extended from the government through all the people with the passage of Lex Hortensia. But then when I got to 250 BC, the other argument came back and said, no. And in fact, in the notes that I had written from other sources, from other books, it said Rome could never have been a sovereign entity until it secured its borders in 250 BC. And I don't know how many times I had said that, but I just came back from Arizona, and I read that quote out, and I just froze in class.
It's amazing.
I said, well, we're not sovereign then. We haven't secured our borders. And our borders are all over the place. So how can we pretend to be a world power? Like you have said, Mike, it doesn't matter how many nuclear submarines you have. If you have a million cartel operatives working in the United States, it doesn't matter how many nuclear submarines or how many stealth bombers you have, because they're already here.
Well, one of the things that I do is there's a group called L&L Freed Associates. They do seminars for the government. In fact, I'll be on the road with them in Huntsville later on this month. They do a lot of seminars for the military, the intelligence services, or whatever, the government agencies. And I was in front of a number of folks from the U.S. Air Force one day, and I said, folks, I don't want to upset anybody. These were primarily generals and colonels. And I said, don't go for your sidearm. I'm not wearing body armor today. But why on earth do we still have a military? And, boy, they looked real angry. And I said, well, here's my point. Is it not correct to say that the primary objective of any military is to keep the enemies as far from the country that it protects, as far from that country's shores as possible? How on earth can you carry out your primary mission when our borders essentially only exist on maps and there are already millions, arguably tens of millions of illegal aliens in our country, living in just about every town and city from coast to coast and border to border, and no reliable authoritative way of determining their true name, their true nationality, who they're affiliated with, what their backgrounds are, and what their intentions are. You know, let's look at Iran. You know, the Iranian problem is still clicking right along. The news has kind of forgotten about it. It doesn't mean it's not happening. It's amazing. You know, most people think if they don't see it in the news, it's no longer happening or it didn't happen at all.
Right.
But the Iranian problem is continuing on. Israel is very focused on the fact that Iran certainly seems hell-bent, and I literally mean that, on developing nuclear weapons and missiles to deliver them. And you know that Ahmadinejad has made it clear that his first objective will be to blow up Israel. And he also made it clear that even if the Israelis, not American forces, go in to take out their nuclear program, that they will make America pay the price. So
right.
Arguably, I don't even know how many thousands, and this was raised at a congressional hearing that Congressman Peter King of New York, he chairs the House Homeland Security Committee, but the concern is there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of sleeper agents who are already inside the United States from Iran waiting for a phone call. But on top of that, there was a Pentagon report in 2010 about how right now in Venezuela there are increasing numbers of CUDs, which are the Iranian shock troops. These are the guys that go in, and they're the commandos. They blow up the buildings. They do the sabotage, okay? So we have a growing number of CUDs in Venezuela. We know that there are terrorist training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil abuts with Argentina and Paraguay. And among the terrorist organizations that are training there are members of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Hezbollah. Hezbollah works hand in glove with the Iranian government.
Mm-hmm.
So look at what we do by leaving that southern border wide open. You have Middle Eastern men or women living in Venezuela, living in Brazil for a number of years. They are totally immersed in the language, the culture of Latin America. How difficult do you suppose it would be, folks, for Mohammed to get a passport from Venezuela, you know, Hugo Chavez, not our friend, and then come to the United States and claim to be from Latin America? Mohammed becomes Miguel. And if you don't think that that's a very real possibility, realize that every one of the terrorists who have been identified thus far had a job. And usually the job that they have provides them with mobility and camouflage. They drive cabs, they drive an ice cream truck. It's a job that allows them to move around easily and not, expose them to scrutiny. And I can tell you, having done surveillance for many years, it's one thing if a guy pulls into a parking lot and walks up to some other guy and they shake hands and you say, well, they're having a meeting. Maybe they just exchanged an envelope, so you know something is going on. When a guy is driving a cab or a van or an ice cream truck, think how many people that person comes into contact with where it could be a normal routine part of his job, and you'll never know whether or not the person that just bought the ice cream and got a bag of supposed ice cream in it didn't just also get in that bag of ice cream a message, money, a memory chip for a computer, whatever. And maybe when he passed the money, folded into the money was another memory chip. Think how much information we could put on that. I mean, you remember the World War II movies with the micro dots and the microfilm, and it was a big deal. Today, a memory chip from a computer can hold a library. So you have these people interacting routinely, and we're being told this is not a problem. How insane is this?
That's right on the mark. And you think of any type of work like that. Landscapers here in North Carolina, you know, they're all independent. And, you know, we can look. I don't know. You know, I've heard from you and others that have stated that when they do arrest somebody that is a pretty hardened criminal, they'll say that people around them said we had no idea. They always smiled. They always said hello. They were the hardest workers. You know, all of those things that are obvious. They know us too well, and so they use our own systems against us. And you know, it's really pretty scary. I had a picture that was sent. I call it deer cam. You can laugh about that if you want to. When they put the cameras out along
duck
the border.
A duck blind.
Yeah. And a picture came, was sent to me, had 46 people in it. And in that picture, there were people, I mean, the border is you know, transnational. I mean, it appeared the second person in it was from China. There was at least three people armed within it, people of different complexions, and, you know, and they were never found. There was no report that was done that, you know, anyone else knew about it, just that silent deer cam that snapped the shot. And so how many other places like that? I saw this morning that in Texas, similar problems that they're having to where they're losing control of certain parts of that sector. So they look for the path of least resistance, just like any game would.
But we're providing it. It was so naive.
Right.
You know, I remember years ago, 60 Minutes did a story about one of these Nazi dirtbags who was running one of the death camps.
Right.
And what was so remarkable about it was that the incredible part of it is that people said, I can't believe he was a Nazi war criminal. He mowed his lawn and smiled at me and my children every morning. I mean, are we talking about the crabgrass police? You know, I was on Lou Dobbs tonight so many times that I'll try to tell a condensed version of the story. But one day Kitty Pilgrim was filling in for Lou, and I was in the makeup room. They were trying to make it look like I'm still breathing. Pretty soon I would tell them they'd need to get an embalmer instead of a makeup artist for me. But there I am. They're doing the makeup, and Kitty comes in and says, we're going to talk about national security. I said, that's fine. And I said, you know, thinking about it, when I talked at my daughter's class when she was in fourth grade, they used to love to have me come in and talk about being an agent and bring along my bulletproof vest and my handcuffs and the walkie-talkie and all the other paraphernalia.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always give the kids a little talk about, you know, drugs and how dangerous they are. And if you find a gun in someone's house, always presume it's real. And if it's real, always presume it's loaded. So don't touch it. Get an adult and have them take it out of the room and make the situation safe. And I said, if you're walking along and – this is more of a city thing, I guess, than a concern for you in your neck of the woods, and someone asks for directions, you're 10 years old, don't go near the car. Because, you know, you could wind up getting abducted. If some guy needs directions, you could tell him, yeah, that main street down there is where you need to go. If he needs more than that, just tell him that you don't know and just keep on walking. Not your problem, because they said you never know who a bad guy is. And this one kid jumps up and says, Mr. Cutler, I could easily spot the bad guy. And I'm thinking, boy, this ought to be good. And I said, okay, Timmy, how can you tell someone's a bad guy? He said, well, he's got a bad complexion, he's wearing a black ninja suit, and he's carrying nunchuck sticks. And I turned to Kitty Pilgrim, and you had to be there because the makeup room was filled. Everybody was there. There were all kinds of broadcasters and guests getting their makeup and their hair done, you know. It was a packed room. And I said, Kitty, do you know where that young man is today? And she said, I have no idea. I said, well, he's now President George W. Bush's advisor on national security. And the whole room, of course, broke up laughing. But that is the simplistic view we have. Well, the guy's a nice guy, and he smiled at me. Does it get any dopier than that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How's that for a bad story?
That's bad. What's really crazy is that you could actually have somebody with Hezbollah that becomes a Bible salesman, and they wouldn't care.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, that's just
so
their nature.
I mean, you know, somebody once said that an effective spy, and you could say this about a terrorist, is somebody who would not attract the attention of a waiter or waitress at a greasy spoon diner. And I could expand on that and tell you that a terrorist or a spy might in fact be that waiter or waitress in that greasy spoon. In fact, out in Staten Island here in New York City, we arrested a guy who was washing dishes, and it turned out he was doing coupon fraud, and this was just before we had gotten intelligence reports on how coupon fraud was being used to fund the PLO and buying explosives to carry out attacks. So here's a guy working in a diner from Egypt in great physical shape. In fact, when he took off on us, he ran through the parking lot. He was literally running on the roofs and hoods of the cars parked in the lot. It was a hell of a chase, but we did get him finally. And the guy was doing coupon fraud. When we went into the apartment looking for his passport, he must have had 20 or 30 shopping bags filled to the brim with coupons. This was a big operation.
That was just an amazing story, because you talked about how much money they were able to raise from that, and that's just astounding. And going right back into organized crime.
And terrorism and so forth. You know, yeah, I mean, that's what people don't understand. And by the way, something else to think about, folks, just as, and I said this to the people from the Air Force. you know, not everyone who wears the Air Force uniform is a pilot. In fact, probably fewer than 5 or 6%
right.
of all the people who proudly wear the Air Force blue go to work in a cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
The other people have a supporting job. Think how many people were behind the scenes every time they launched the space shuttle. Think how many thousands of people got the Apollo astronauts to the moon. These guys are literally riding the tip of the spear.
Mm-hmm.
Think of how many terrorists are involved, whether part-time or full-time, who will never hijack an airplane, never set off a bomb, never fire a gun. Their job is to get money, whether it's by getting contributions to supposed charitable organizations, whether it's to commit crime, whether it's to, you know, get people just to give money, whatever they do. There are other people who come in. Their job is to provide a room, so if a stranger comes in and gives them the magic password, they provide them with a bed where they can sleep for as long as they need to. You have others that may be going around the city taking photographs of potential targets, scouting out potential future operations. There are all kinds of jobs that are needed for a terrorist organization, just as there are so many different jobs that our people in the military need to carry out, or people in law enforcement. It isn't simply the people that are going to blow up buildings or hijack airplanes.
Yeah, I was in combat arms in the Army, and we had a unit that was next to us when I was overseas in Europe that they always got to stay in the back, and they used to laugh and see us. We were the ones that had to run every morning doing calisthenics, and then we were gone in the field for extended periods of time. And it was there that I realized, you know, when you look at the overall military, it's the combat effective is only a quarter or maybe less of it is actually in combat. So it takes the biggest bulk, three quarters or more, to support the few that are actually doing the combat missions.
Yeah, and that's the point that people need to understand. But understand the people that have those supporting roles are no less significant, because without them, the job doesn't get done.
All the logistics and language and training that has to go on, and I would believe that just to get to from Iran to Brazil, all of the funding that has to be done for those. But see, when you talk about cuts forces, I mean, you're talking about, say, someone similar to a Green Beret, and a large number of them are training on our part of the world. I mean, why are they training here? I mean, what's the point of sending Iranian troops to South America to train and to learn Spanish customs unless they have one clear design? I mean,
that's amazing.
That would be, they're looking right at us. They're not training to attack Venezuela or Brazil, I would assume.
I would assume, but meanwhile, look at what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really think that when they go to their mosques, they say a little prayer, "Dear God, let our enemy be stupid," and we don't disappoint them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, folks, and that's why, you know, what we're talking about, whether it's Mark, who's been doing an amazing job in North Carolina, he's an activist as well as a professor, and, you know, we really owe you. We owe you and all of the people that you work with. This is an American effort. This isn't, by the way, about being a conservative. I know that you're a conservative. I'm not. And that's fine. We're Americans. We're supposed to disagree. It's our birthright. The First Amendment, folks, as
mm-hmm.
I often point out, isn't just about freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion. It's also about the right to seek redress of grievances.
That's
and it's
right.
about the right to peaceably assemble so that we can have the discourse, the debate, hopefully come to some compromise and better understandings. But we're supposed to be not agreeing with each other, but respecting each other as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've allowed are the politicians to divide us up, conservative and liberal and Hispanic versus white, black versus, you know, Asian. We're Americans. If you're an American citizen, then that's what unites us. That's what's so critical. It's the immigration issue that mm-hmm. seeks to tear this country apart by blurring that distinction between what it is to be a citizen versus an alien, which is why the term alien has become so contentious. There's nothing bigoted about the term alien. It's a legal term. It simply means any person who is not a citizen or national of the United States. And every other country on the planet uses a comparable term because it clearly defines what you're doing as an immigration officer. the distinction is whether or not the person that you're dealing with is a United States citizen. And in fact, when I was an inspector, I don't know if I told you this, Mark, but when people came into my booth at that airport, if they were an American citizen, we would examine them. If they were an alien, we would inspect them. And the reason that they make that distinction is so that it's very clear that the process is different if we're not dealing with a U.S. citizen. U.S. citizens cannot be denied entry into the United States. Aliens can. So from day one, that distinction between alien and citizen, when you go to Border Patrol Academy, or today it's the Federal Law Enforcement Training Facility, it's hammered into your head from day one, the distinction between what it is to be an American citizen versus what it is to not be an American, or in other words, an alien. Other countries see it the same way. But the politicians who have an agenda, who are taking the campaign contributions, are doing everything they can to muddy the water. We as Americans have to be smarter than that. We should be embracing our fellow Americans, even when we disagree with them, because at the end of the day, we're in this together. And that's an issue that I can't emphasize enough. Would you have any disagreement with that statement, Mark?
No, that's right on the money. When you know, a lot of those things that we grew up with, they like to keep people divided between Republican or Democrat, or even, I don't know how much up in New York it would be, but even like to keep that division between North and South, or Sheriff Deaver. Some of the people out in Arizona considered me an Easterner when I was there, and I said, I've never been called that before.
Oh, my God, and the name-calling continues.
And they said, well, where are you from? I said, I'm from the South. Well, you're east of the Mississippi. And I said, yeah, but okay.
We are so eager to put each other in pigeonholes, aren't we?
Yeah, but they were just laughing. I mean, they were kidding around, and they still, every now and then, when they get in touch with me, do that. But when you look at Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, all of those distinctions are meaningless, because if you don't have an alien, then you don't have a border.
That's right.
And so then if you don't have a border, you're not a nation. We're just an entity.
Yes. And, well, you know, my famous line, or as my friend Aaron Stipkovitz over at And Magazine would say, my Cutlerism on that one, is that a country without secure borders can almost stand and can a house without walls.
That's right. And, you know, and when you look at particularly young people who, I don't know what kind of training they're getting growing up in schools.
They're not in your classroom, that's obvious.
No, but whenever they look around and say that these people are just trying to get here for help, well, sure. I mean, there are. If I lived, or if you lived in Mexico and you lived underneath cartel areas where it's so violent, I would want to get out of there too. But the point that has to bear in mind is that we are the big enemy to just about, I would say, 90% of the world. And so, if they wanted to seek to try to get in here, well, they'll use the same mechanisms. So, if you're going to naively think because this one or that one is trying to better his life, which, you know, they should get in line and do it, go through the process that's already set up. We got a good process. Just utilize it. You know, don't go around it. But then they use the exact same system, and they use our own feelings as Americans, where we like to go and help the underdog. I mean, that's just who we are. That's who we pull for, and so. But if you're an evil person, they say, "Well, this is easy. This is all you got to do to get in."
Well, do you know how many terrorists? And you know, we talked about the Holocaust and my own family background. Obviously, when I think about political asylum and refugees, it strikes a resonant chord in my heart. In fact, back when I was in college, I was the president of a B'nai B'rith group. In 1964 or 65, I went to Washington when President Lyndon Johnson was in the Oval Office. And we demonstrated across from the White House with the government was happy to see us, by the way. We didn't go crazy out there. But we amassed, I forget if it was 10 or 20,000 people, and we were holding up signs and asking President Johnson to work with the Russians to convince them to let their ethnic minorities, whether they were Jews or others, emigrate and go to other countries where they could practice their religions and experience freedom. And in fact, Dr. Ralph Abernathy, who had worked very closely with Dr. Martin Luther King, came out and spoke in support of what we were doing and read a telegram that Dr. Martin Luther King had written, supporting our position. So out at the airport, it was a thrill for me as an inspector to admit refugees into the United States who had come from the Soviet Union and other places where they were being oppressed. And not just people who were Jewish, but people of all faiths, people of all ethnicities. Well, do you know how many terrorists have used political asylum as a ploy to gain entry into our country and set up shop in the United States? There's a guy by the name of Amir Kansi, who in 1993, January 93, from Pakistan, got political asylum by lying. And he saw in our generosity and our kindness weakness. He repaid us by standing outside the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, with an AK-47, opened fire as cars were being driven into the compound that winter morning, killed two CIA officers, wounded three others, fled the country, which, by the way, is one of the things that these folks can do. They have a place where they can escape. And so he fled back to Pakistan. Our people grabbed him, brought him back here, put him on trial, found him guilty, executed him. But the people he killed remained dead. And, of course, we had the first attack at the Trade Center 1 month after that attack. But here's the thing to consider. How many more aliens since then were given political asylum who lied on their applications? There's a guy by the name of Fez Hazian who a couple of years ago, this is an ICE press release, they were bragging about it, 23-year-old guy from Eritrea, got political asylum, applied for it, and in less than, I think it was 6 weeks, they granted political asylum. He said he was running for his life in Eritrea. I can't imagine anybody went there to conduct the investigation. And the way that it came out was the story that they wrote about in the ICE press release was that he was grabbed for smuggling aliens through Guatemala into the United States from Africa. Be aware of the fact that there are some places in Africa where Al-Qaeda has developed a real strong toehold. So you may well have been dealing with somebody who was smuggling terrorists into the United States. They grabbed him and charged him and said, you know, at the time he claimed he was running for his life in Eritrea, he was in Guatemala probably running from law enforcement because he was smuggling aliens. But by not stripping him of his political asylum, because there was no mention of it in the article, what this means is that even though he was convicted and even though he was about to be sentenced to jail time, when he gets out of jail, no one's going to look to deport him because he was granted political asylum. Now, think how foolish this is. This should have been a focus of the investigation of, hey, you know what? This guy's a smuggler. He lied on the application. Let's prosecute him for committing, you know, fraud on that application. We had a drug dealer, and I had a major screaming match with a U.S. attorney in New Jersey, who at the time that we swore him in as a new U.S. citizen was actually a guy who had been convicted of a number of criminal offenses that should have got him deported. And he lied about it on his application. So when I went to the U.S. attorney and said, you know, we could prosecute this guy for naturalization fraud. In fact, he was out on bail pending sentencing for yet another crime when we swore him in as an American citizen. And the U.S. attorney said to me, well, Mr. Cutler, we're already charging this guy with drugs. What's the big deal about somebody lying on their application for citizenship? Can you believe that one?
Yeah, and the other one is how many times you hear on the news where the person that came over from the Middle East, he was a Muslim, but he wasn't radicalized, in quotes, until he came here and met with this imam or that imam somewhere. So assuming that he was a really good person and came here, and then after that, he got radicalized.
Amazing, isn't it?
To where, you know, we hear this in the news constantly, and you sometimes don't know which way to take it. But when you look at the world situation, then, you know, we have all the evidence out there to point to, you know, that our own nation is in jeopardy. It's in danger. But we continue to move around just like the war on terror, like nothing is happening.
Well, you know, when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer about 12 years ago, I could have ignored it. I could have said to my wife, you know what, let's go on a cruise. Let's make believe this isn't happening. If
right.
I had done that, I wouldn't be here now.
Mm-hmm.
What saved my life was my willingness to address the threat that this cancer posed to my survival. Today, folks, America suffers from a cancer. It's the threat of terrorism. It's the damage being done by increasing numbers of members of transnational gangs and drug cartels into our country. And, you know, they were publishing the statistics today also. And just as an aside, I just want to make this point quickly because we're running out of time. And they always come up with these statistics, the labor statistics of how many jobs were created. What is astonishing to me is that at a time that we talk about creating jobs, not one politician talks about the need to liberate jobs. And, you know, I confronted former Speaker Newt Gingrich when I spoke at the Tea Party convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, a couple of months ago. Interesting experience. Newt was on stage before I was, and he left the stage. I came up on stage afterwards. I joked that he was my warm-up act, but of course not really. But when I bumped into him at the bar that night with his wife and his phalanx of you know, agents protecting him, his security force, I said, "Mr. Speaker, I have a fast question for you." And he said, "Sure, go ahead." And I said, "With all this talk about creating jobs, why don't you talk about the need to liberate jobs? It takes time and money to create jobs. You have to build buildings. You have to get the money. It has to be it's time-consuming.
Yeah, it is.
But if you go and enforce the immigration laws as you're taking the illegal workforce out the back door, you could be bringing the legal workforce in through the front door the very same day." And
yes,
the guy looked at me like the proverbial deer stuck in the headlights of an oncoming 18-wheeler. He had nothing to say. And that's the question that I want you folks out there to give thought to.
Mm-hmm.
There are millions of people working in our country today who should not be here.
Mm-hmm.
Not only are they working here, but they're sending their money home. That is money that is not being spent in America, money not being invested in America. Meanwhile, Americans are losing their jobs, are relying on the safety net systems, which is very costly, Americans losing their homes to foreclosure, losing their ability to pay for college educations for their children, although with the way we bring in foreign high-tech workers, you have to wonder about the value of an education in America today. But at the very same time that we see all this happening, we see nothing being done to get rid of the illegal alien workforce. And, in fact, the administration has taken to a tactic, and I testified about this in January of last year, that's known as silent raids. You cannot make this up, silent raids, where the employer is subject to prosecution, fines, and so forth, but the aliens are not. Is that amazing or is that amazing?
That's amazing.
So you look at this and you say, well, where is the disincentive to run the border and come to the United States and get a job? We're allowing aliens who work here illegally to file tax returns to get money back for children back home. And believe me, there's no way of verifying if those kids even exist. These aren't kids in America, and it's not even their immediate children. They're putting down nieces and nephews. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. So we're doing everything in our power to encourage and entice ever greater numbers of illegal aliens to come to America, work here, and send money home, either through remittances or through this wacky tax program.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, we're losing our expectations of privacy and freedom in the name of national security. You know, the visa waiver program is another thing I jump up and down about. Whenever I fly, you're always concerned the shoe's got to come off because of Richard Reid, the shoe bomber. He was a Brit. He got on the airplane without a visa because as a British national, he's allowed. But guess what? He'd still be allowed to get on the airplane without a visa today because they've expanded the visa waiver program, even as the TSA is groping four-year-old little girls who go to hug their grandmothers as they're trying to get on an airplane.
Yeah.
I mean, the stories are incredible. These would almost be urban myth stories, but these aren't urban myths. They are really playing out across our country, and we the people are allowing the folks in office to continue on. My dad used to tell me that I would teach people how they should treat me by demonstrating what I was willing to accept. We as a country have made it clear to the elected folks out there that we will accept everything and anything because we allow these people to get reelected time and time again. You know, we go to restaurants, we're very specific about the food that we want to eat, the way that we want it prepared. We need to be no less specific when we deal with our elected representatives. A good step in the right direction is to listen to my program and other programs, get as much information as you can, arrive at reasonable decisions, and then make certain that as a matter of routine, you get a hold of your elected representatives and give them clear marching orders. They are our employees. Imagine if you did on your job what these folks do on their job. You wouldn't last a week.
Yep. Well, and it's kind of like in the history, another quick history lesson. we've allowed ourselves to fall right back into a colonial type of government, to where we export all of our resources overseas for other people to make at slave wages, and then deprive American workers their jobs, or depress the amount that they're going to get paid to just further erode our own society. It's almost like we're going back to before 1773.
Remarkable, isn't it?
History repeats itself, which I used to hate when people would say that. I'd say it doesn't repeat. It kind of goes in a wave. It goes up and down. But the more and more you look at it, the more that you continue to stop teaching history and learning, you know, why we did what we did in 1775 and 76, then you look at today and you hear young people say things like, well, sometimes the government has to have coercion in a democracy. And you just look at them and say, what? Explain that one again. But, you know, we're doing it to ourselves. And now it seems like we don't really care if we are, and we just put a blind eye and hoping that we're walking right through whatever the case would be and nothing would happen. Kind of like my youngest daughter would say if a dog barks at us walking down the road, saying, if you don't look at it, it won't see us.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talked about that, that when a kid comes out of the shower, if they're embarrassed, they cover their own eyes.
Yeah.
We've all seen this.
Yeah. But we're doing the same thing, and we're adults, and we pretend that it's not happening.
It's incredible, isn't it? None is so blind as he who will not see.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But, you know, and that's why we're here, you know. I'm here, and Mark, I know you do a great job with your cohort, the other Mark. You're making your mark in history over in North Carolina. But that's why I do this radio program. I'm sure that's why you do your show, and that's why I do the programs that I do over at AND Magazine at TalkBorder.com. By the way, why don't you go to your website for your radio program? With all this talk about my websites, you know, CAPS, you know, California's Population
right.
Stabilization, CAPSWeb.org, what's your radio station website?
It's WSIC in Statesville, North Carolina, Your Mark on History. You can go to WSIC.com. It's been a while since I looked at it so much, but you can click on Your Mark on History for programming, and it's streamed live, and we're working on other matters with it to where we can get it archived, and so you can go back and listen to previous editions, which occasionally we do. We'll put those up on the website, and then also on the within the those that are in the Tea Party movement, you can go to the Yadkin Valley, which is Yadkin Valley, teaparty.com, and you can also link to it on it. And that's where some, you know, get into it from, you know, tea groups across the country and will listen in.
Well, that
but
sounds like a plan.
Remember, I don't have any broadcasting or radio or whatever experience. I just talk, and I really love U.S. history and this nation, and as a veteran, and I especially admire our law enforcement agents, especially people like you who have served so well in difficult surroundings, too, I may say. It's
well,
not easy.
No, it wasn't. It was a challenge. I used to say that the biggest obstacle I faced every day when I went on duty was the very same government that put me out there on the street.
Right.
Unfortunately, but I do appreciate the kind words. But, you know, folks, what I ask of all of you is to be worthy of the sacrifices and the courage of our law enforcement, of our military, of the men and women in the dangerous professions, the firefighters and the EMTs and so forth, who really form that thin line to protect all of us from lots of stuff that's out there. So that's what I ask of you. Take your citizenship seriously. Think of how many people died so that we could vote. Think how many people have given their lives or have given their health so that the Constitution is the document of this country. And we're watching it being whittled away almost daily. And if it doesn't upset you, it should. And this isn't a conservative perspective or a liberal perspective.
That's
this
right.
is an American perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes,
it is that Constitution that honors the idea of discourse and debate. Think of that First Amendment, the right to peaceably assemble. You know, the Founding Fathers did it live and in person. They'd get under a shade tree or in a barn or a church or a synagogue or a school or someone's house. Well, we still do it today that way. I did it when I came out to North Carolina, and it was great. Mm. But we also conduct those meetings on talk radio, on the internet, on Facebook, television. There are so many media out there, and politicians from both sides of the aisle don't like it. They don't like the idea that the American people are getting together and educating themselves and having these discussions, because the game they keep playing with increasing frequency is divide and conquer. We're told, well, it's not a border issue, it's a Latino issue, it's this issue, it's that issue. It's crazy. They're even saying, well, if you want the Latino vote and you're a politician, you have to give illegal alien citizenship. How does that help an American citizen? And I don't care if that person is Latino or black or white or Asian or has pink polka dots. If you're an American citizen, those laws are designed to protect your lives and protect your jobs and protect our middle class. That's what those laws are about. But there is this myth being perpetrated. And one of the things that saddens me, Mark, is I am sure that there are some folks out there that have trouble thinking clearly who will hear somebody having a little accent that that guy must be an alien. Simply because they've been conditioned by unscrupulous media, by unscrupulous corporations, by politicians, that, you know, we're dealing with, you know, xenophobia. This isn't about xenophobia. The immigration laws are simply designed to protect America and Americans from foreign nationals whose presence would be harmful to us in one way or another. And it's in the law. Go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 212. See the listing of categories of aliens who are supposed to be kept out of the country. And then ask yourself, how many of those categories can we ignore? How comfortable would you be if the guy that lives in a house next door to you fell into one of those categories, an alien with a dangerous communicable disease or mental illness and is prone to violence, or a sex offender, convicted felon, human rights violator, war criminal, drug smuggler, prostitutes, gang members, and so forth? That's not what we want to see in our neighborhoods, folks. It's not what we want to see in our country, and that's why we have those laws. And we're trying to protect the American middle class at the same time. So,
yes, we are.
Having said all that, we're certainly down to the wire. And I'll speak with you off air. I'll give you a call right afterwards. I have a question on behalf of a friend, so I'll give you a call. But, you know, I just want to thank you so much for being on my show today. Last Monday, you were thanking me for being on your program.
Right.
Tell your partner in crime, the other Mark over there, that I say hello. But I do
sure
thank
will.
You. And I hope to get you back here real soon. In fact, we have to get you on a Skype, perhaps over at talkborder.com. I'd love to do that also with you one day.
All right. I can do that.
Good. Tell your family I say hello.
I sure will. And we'll go outside in a little bit to see if the whippoorwills are still out.
Send me a recording of their song. I want to thank all of you for joining me this Friday evening, as we do every Friday. I'm glad that you're there listening. I hope you find these programs entertaining, but also educational. All that I ask that you remember, folks, is that at the end of the day, democracy is not a spectator sport. Please take your citizenship seriously. Please establish an ongoing relationship with your elected representatives and make certain that, in fact, they do represent you. Have a great weekend, everybody. I look forward to seeing you again next week at the same time. Bye-bye.
Bye.